Hey, Beast and Bible listeners, just a heads up, while this episode deals with some very interesting and even fun aspects of Halloween, there are some very real life and grown-up events and themes that are discussed, including real crimes and real violence. So please use discretion. Okay, here we go.
Yet year after year, it's the same routine, and I grow so weary of the sound of screams. And I, Jack, the Pumpkin King, have grown so tired of the same old thing.
In Tim Burton's holiday classic, The Nightmare Before Christmas, Jack Skellington of Halloween Town tires of the same old thing. One night, he stumbles upon a ring of trees in a dark wood that leads to other holiday lands. He slips into Christmas, is dazzled, and eventually kidnaps Santa Claus and attempts to execute his own macabre version of the Merry Holiday. Disaster ensues. There is another nightmare related to Jack's holiday of Halloween that is created not by well-spoken skeletons, but Christians enjoying a seasonal moral panic with a side of pumpkin spice. Beginning in mid-September, they spin wild tales of witches, demons, nefarious nighttime activities, and sensational testimonies about escaping secret cults. But this year, a new one popped up on Ye Olde Facebook, claiming a Barbie-themed Ouija board was threatening the souls of our children this Halloween. Where in the hot pink necromancy did this come from?
She's not dead, she's just having an existential crisis.
Putting panic on pause to spend 5 minutes Googling reveals the following facts about the Barbie Ouija board. Number one, Hasbro makes Ouija, Mattel makes Barbie. They are competitors, and if they were going to collaborate, it would probably not be on this. Two, the image of a girl with a Barbie Ouija is from January 2021. It's cropped up now likely due to the popularity of the Barbie movie. Number three, it's created by Servando Hernandez, whose Livin' in Plastic platform features a series of products decontextualized from their normal associations. And finally, you can buy cheap imitations of the product based on Servando's design on Etsy.
The real world isn't what I thought it was.
So, in summary, did someone create a Barbie Ouija board? Yes. Is it an official product launched to ensnare our children? Nope. Are we going to panic like it is? You bet your jack-o'-lantern we will. There exists an unholy host of evangelical folk tales and horror stories that rival Hollywood productions when it comes to preventing people from celebrating Halloween. Well-meaning Christians are so desperate to keep people from what they see as a gateway into devilish realities that they are willing to believe sensational stories and even lie in order to get results.
Everybody thinks it's fake and innocent, but they could be casting any type of spell that they want to. Anything could be coming through that TV screen.
In this special four-part series of Beast and Bible, we explore these dynamics along with history and culture haunting the controversial holiday.
It's important to note up front, I am not a Halloween apologist. I am a moral panic preventionist. In other words, I'm not here to defend Halloween, but I am here to mitigate unhealthy panic and anxiety that lead us to be the worst versions of ourselves and poor witnesses to the truth.
I'm calling this first episode, The Nightmare Before Halloween. I'm Dr. Seth Pierce, and welcome to the Beast and Bible Halloween Special. There is a meme of Anton LaVey, founder of the Church of Satan in 1966, that says, quote, "I'm glad that Christian parents let their children worship the devil at least one night out of the year," end quote. It creeps around social media as the mimetic equivalent of a proof text demonstrating once and for all that Halloween is the devil's holiday. Except LaVey never said that. After hunting for years for a source of the quote, the Church of Satan on October 30th, 2020 posted the following on Twitter. Quote, "As far as we know, it's fake. In trying to find an original source, we can only find various Christian websites referencing each other. There are no interviews or sources ever cited," end quote. In the comments section, the Church of Satan continues, "Our best assumption is that this is a paraphrasing of an oft-repeated sentiment that Halloween is a sort of, quote, amateur hour to Satanists, end quote, because people explore their darker sides." What we have here is the Church of Satan lecturing Christians on ethics and honesty and being right. It's the kind of thing that's embarrassing to the point of wanting to scream. There's another idea that finds its way online and on t-shirts and stickers and other merch, declaring that Halloween is Satan's birthday.
Halloween is about me, and I deserve a party. This shall be my super sweet 16. Ha 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 ha!
This is also not true for the obvious reason that we have no idea when the angel formerly known as Lucifer was created.
Like anyone can even know that.
And while it may ring true to some, the origins of the idea are comical. Like, literally found in a comic. Jack Chick was a controversial and quite frankly awful, unhinged, and dishonest cartoonist in the 1980s who created numerous tracks in comic book style. The graphics and disturbing content of these tracks was distributed in the millions in the 1980s and 90s and still makes an occasional appearance. Due to their dramatic images and easy-to-access copy, these tracks created numerous myths that embedded themselves in the cultural imagination. In the 1981 tract, Boo, one of the panels features a satanic priest holding a cat down on an altar. With knife raised high, he praises the devil and says, quote, "We sacrifice this cat on your birthday," end quote. Not only do we find this link to the devil's alleged birthday, but we also see the legend of sacrificing a feline on Halloween. Growing up, I would hear warnings of not allowing your cat out on this holiday for fear of it being used in some dark ritual. However, many humane societies from Oregon to Kentucky have posted warnings about perpetuating this myth, as it hinders adoption of black cats. While some people abuse cats, the idea that there are legions of occultists out shopping for animal sacrifices on October 31 doesn't have merit. The only thing that they might say is keep your pets inside on Halloween because of the high traffic and inability to see the animals that are wandering the streets. There's also religious sleights of hand this time of year. Take, for example, an evangelist who posted a picture of a Halloween decoration in the store that looked like a dark angel. He lamented the ghoulishness of it and said this is why he tells Christians not to celebrate. The problem is he's lambasting people for using it as a decoration in stores and in their yards, but he himself is using it on his social media to capture attention in order to get people to view his Halloween special, the link of which was provided after his rebuke of those who celebrate. Further exploration of the evangelist's website reveals dynamic illustrations of ghosts and witches to attract viewers to various videos warning them against the occult. Now, of course, someone will point out that the evangelist isn't using these diabolical images to promote the occult, but then likely neither were the people buying the Halloween decorations. Perhaps the most well-known myth is that of the razor blade and the apple. Where does this come from? This is a bit trickier, pun intended. On November 1, 1964, the New York Times published a report entitled L.I. Children Get Poisoned Treat, Accused Housewife Committed. We find out that police had arrested 47-year-old Helen Feel for handing out packages of, quote, ant buttons, steel wool pads, and dog biscuits, and had wrapped them in aluminum foil. The ant buttons, about the size and shape of a bottle cap, are used to kill ants, roaches, flies, and other insects and mice. They are marked with a skull and crossbones and are labeled poison, keep away from children and animals, end quote. She said it was a joke, and she only handed them out to trick-or-treaters she felt were too old. Authorities, however, who managed to track down the 12 bags she handed out before they could hurt someone, did not find it funny at all, and she was sent to Central Islip State Hospital for observation. In 1970, the New York Times published an unhinged article entitled Those Treats May Be Tricks by Judy Klemsrud, which states, quote, take, for example, that plump red apple that Junior gets from a kindly old woman down the block. It may have a razor blade hidden inside. The chocolate candy bar may be a laxative. The bubble gum may be sprinkled with lye. The popcorn balls may be coated with camphor. The candy may turn out to be packets containing sleeping pills, end quote. She goes on to cite Dr. Hollis S. Ingram, New York State Health Commissioner, who said recently in his annual Halloween safety bulletin, quote, children should not eat any of their collected goodies until they have been carefully examined by an adult. In recent years, pins, razor blades, slivers of glass, and poison have appeared in the treats gathered by children across New York State, end quote. However, later studies that we'll look at in a moment demonstrate that these diabolical desserts either never existed, were pranks by trick-or-treaters, or were very few in number with little to no serious injury and never really verified. However, Helen Feel's Halloween hijinks was still fresh in the cultural imagination, so people were primed for pins, blades, and poison. Especially after an incident on October 31, 1974, which is referred to by historian David J. Scull as The Candyman's Tale in his excellent book Death Makes a Holiday. It's a book I highly recommend for his detailed account, but for now, here's the short version. Ronald Clark O'Brien was a 30-year-old optician in suburban Houston. He accompanied his 8-year-old son Timothy and 5-year-old daughter Elizabeth on their trick-or-treating rounds. O'Brien was a financial mess, having lost his home and now ran the risk of losing his car next. Yet, on this night, his kids wore name-brand costumes as they haunted the neighbors for sweets. They were joined by his friend Jim Bates and his two kids, Kimberly and Mark, in the Bates' neighborhood. it began to rain. When the children returned without candy from a house with its lights on, O'Brien decided to give it a try on their behalf as they continued up the street. He arrived a few moments later, celebrating his friend's wealthy neighbors. O'Brien held out 5 giant pixie sticks. If you've never heard of them, they are tubes filled with sweet and sour sugar in a variety of colors. When they arrived back at the Bates' house, O'Brien gave 4 of the candies to the kids and then to one trick-or-treater who knocked at the door, a 10-year-old boy named Whitney Parker. After that, the Bates and Parker said goodnight. Once home, Timothy O'Brien asked if he could have his giant pixie stick before bed. He didn't notice that the straw had been opened at the end, but noticed when the contents were clumpy and wouldn't come out. His father took the candy and massaged the tube until the contents were loose and his son could eat them. "It tastes bitter," said Timothy. 30 seconds later, Timothy was crying out in pain as his stomach twisted into knots before he fell on the ground in convulsions, vomiting, and gasping for air. Tragically, he died before he made it to the hospital. The autopsy revealed enough potassium cyanide to kill 3 adults. Miraculously, the authorities were able to arrive at the Bates' house before any of their kids consumed the poison treats, as well as locating Whitney Parker before he ate the deadly sweet. For the next few weeks, O'Brien worked with authorities to retrace his steps in the hopes of finding out who perpetrated this monstrous crime. However, later records would reveal that O'Brien called his insurance agent the very morning after Timothy passed away. You see, 9 days before Halloween, O'Brien had acquired 2 $20,000 insurance policies on Timothy and Elizabeth. Now he was calling to collect. David J. Skahl chronicles the odd behaviors in his book that O'Brien displayed at Timothy's funeral and the mixed narratives he gave police that led to growing suspicion. As things unraveled, it was revealed that Ronald O'Brien, nicknamed the man who killed Halloween, was the murderer. He was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to death by lethal injection in June 1975. He was executed in March 1984. Fear of Halloween sadism, or intentional poisoning of kids' candy, spiked in the 1980s. The Satanic Panic, which we dealt with in our last 2 episodes, had everyone on high alert for murderous Satanists attacking children. Secondly, in 1982, 7 people died when bottles of Tylenol were tampered with. Known as the Tylenol murders, this frightening tragedy involved someone putting lethal doses of potassium cyanide inside the popular pain reliever bottles. It was headline news in every major paper on October 1st, gently linking the candy-consuming holiday with a potential new threat.
The first death yesterday morning was in Elk Grove Village, a 12-year-old girl, Mary Kellerman. And then in Arlington Heights, the deaths of 2 brothers and the critical illness of one of their wives. Now tonight, a 4th death in the DuPage County town of Winfield has been linked to the altered medicine. And in Downers Grove, still another death suspected of being cyanide poisoning. The bottles were labeled Extra Strength Tylenol, 50 capsule size, lot number MC2880, expiration date April 1987. If you have a Tylenol bottle marked that way, destroy it.
Incidentally, Johnson & Johnson, the parent company of Tylenol, was brilliant in their response in ensuring safety measures moving forward. It's commonly used as the textbook example in crisis communication courses. Now, couple these dynamics with Ronald O'Brien's execution and Jack Chick's cartoon track shenanigans, and the urban legend is as good as historical fact. Another thread adding to the sinister vibe of Halloween in the 1980s was the American serial killer and sex offender John Wayne Gacy, who murdered over 30 young men. He gave public performances as a clown prior to the bodies of his victims being discovered. Because of this, he became known as the Killer Clown. He was brought to trial on February 6, 1980, and charged with 33 murders. He was convicted and executed in 1994. A serial killer clown, and clowns as classic Halloween costumes, have developed a link in the cultural imagination that Halloween is a murderous holiday. In the 32nd volume, number 5 issue of Social Problems, published in 1985 by Oxford University Press, a systematic treatment of Halloween sadism appears. The article is called The Razor Blade and the Apple, The Social Construction of Urban Legends. The piece looked at the panic in the 1970s and early 80s, panic that even inspired legislation, and that gave birth to the idea that our candies were laced with evil in the month of October. After scouring the evidence, the authors make 3 conclusions. 1, that the threat of Halloween sadism has been greatly exaggerated. Of course, it's standard good practice to check your food wrappers, whether they be candy or cornstarch, or whether you got them trick-or-treating or at Trader Joe's. 2, that many, if not most, reports of Halloween sadism are of questionable authenticity. and finally, that the press should not be held responsible for the widespread belief that Halloween poses a serious threat. While I initially disagreed with the last point, the authors do demonstrate that, as a topic, Halloween sadism has not been covered that much relative to other issues. It's not that the press didn't play a role, but what the authors found, and what is even more true now with everyone and their fundamentalist parents on social media, is that, quote, knowledge of Halloween sadism apparently spreads by word of mouth, end quote. One of the trickiest treats that Christians consume is the sensationalist testimony. As sober-minded as we like to think we are, there is nothing like a tale of an individual escaping witchcraft, Satanism, the Illuminati, Freemasons, or some other occultist community. And if the new convert could spice it up with a few gory details, then believers can enjoy the horror genre under a guise of spirituality.
I got married on Halloween. I had a demonic wedding on Halloween. I mean, we talk about animal rituals, we talk about blood sacrifices, and Halloween I had a demonic wedding because that is the devil's holiday.
As a Christian pastor, I don't want to minimize spiritual darkness or disparage powerful testimonies of how Christ has worked in someone's life. What I also can't ignore is a long, well-documented history and tradition of what are called moralpreneurs, who either manufacture their backstory or spice it up with devilish details that prey on the fears of faith communities and gets attention and financial support for their platforms. Basically, panic peddlers whose unverifiable "just trust me because I know" tales work to entertain audiences and prop up aspiring evangelists as experts to keep us all safe. People of the cloth have used false testimony for years. In Matthew 28:12-15, we see professed followers of God spreading a false tale to discredit Jesus and the resurrection. Gnostic gospels appear during the early church, and highly sophisticated tales among Protestants to attack Catholics appear in North America in the 19th century. The awful disclosures of Maria Monk, for example, claim that shady sexual practices and murdering of infants was occurring in her convent in Montreal. It was published in 1836, 2 years after Protestants burned down the Ursuline convent in Boston because they were led to believe that nuns were being held against their will. The book, later revealed to be a hoax, was an attempt to cash in on the moral panic of the day. More recently, the book The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven, published in 2010 by Tyndale House, was a bestseller that claimed to reveal Alex Malarkey's experiences in heaven after a life-threatening car accident in 2004. It was co-written by Alex's father, Kevin Malarkey. In 2011, however, it was discredited, with both Alex and Alex's mother distancing themselves from the book and Tyndale pulling the deceptive testimony from the shelves. With all due respect to the victims whose tragedy was used to profit, the irony of a false testimony being written by a man with the last name Malarkey isn't lost on me. There are many accounts making up an entire genre of Christian literature which should give us pause when someone bolsters sensationalist accounts by making even more sensationalist claims about their background and expertise. It's not that we can't trust, but we need to verify. In the 1960s, Stanley Cohen wrote a book called Folk Tales and Moral Panics, in which he distills 5 stages that lead a society to have an exaggerated emotional reaction to an event. After an event occurs that deviates from the norm, which can be anything from a crime to the publishing of a book that challenges tradition or claims to uncover a sinister plot, the stages begin. The first stage is that the press exaggerates the issue or event in a way that becomes symbolic of society's ills and fears. Second, the public reacts to the press's description of the issue. Next, the public persuades law enforcement to get involved in stricter, more punitive ways toward anyone or anything connected to the issue. Fourth, politicians and legislators get involved calling for laws and policies. And finally, action groups such as lobbyists, nonprofits, protesters, and even independent ministries form to deal with the issue. In Numbers 13, we can see a moral panic develop that appears to reflect all of Cohen's stages. Moses sends out men to spy out the promised land that God has said he's going to give them. When the spies return, they bring back produce that puts Whole Foods to shame and give a report in verses 27 to 29. Quote, "We came to the land which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Yet the people who live in the land are strong, and the towns are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the land of the Negeb. The Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live by the sea and along the Jordan." End quote. So an event has occurred. The spying of the land and the noticing of not only agricultural abundance, but there are strong people living there in fortified cities. People become concerned, but a man named Caleb calms them down, reminding them of God's promise and faithfulness. But then the press get involved in 31 to 33. Quote, Then the man who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the Israelites an unfavorable report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim, the Anakites come from the Nephilim, and to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them," end quote. Suddenly, it's not just men in the land, it's giants, boogeymen, and we are nothing but insects. Stage one complete. Now in Numbers 14:1, the public get involved. Quote, "Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night," end quote. The panic is beginning. Stage two complete. Stages three to five kind of happen at once. Sort of like the stages of grief, the stages don't always happen in neat order. Sometimes they happen at once or reversed, but they're all there. In the account in Numbers, stages 4 and 5, which is where legislation and action groups get involved, occurs in verse 4 of chapter 14, when they try to elect a new captain to lead them back to Egypt. As far as stage 3 goes, law enforcement with harsher penalties happens in verse 10, when they try to pick up stones to kill Moses and Aaron after they try to calm them down. The result of this moral panic? God makes them wander the wilderness for 40 years until the moralpreneurs and panickers die off. It's a narrative that gives us a harsh reminder that we don't do our best theology when we panic, and also that panic has real consequences and can make otherwise faithful people say and do terrible things, including murderous actions and being willing to lie. In 2022, a colleague of mine made a post on social media that began with, quote, "I don't understand many Christians' opposition to Halloween," end quote, and then he followed it with some questions. Nearly 200 comments of every kind followed. One that caught my attention was from a pastor who made some spurious claims about the holiday's history. As I looked at it, something seemed off. A quick Google search revealed that this minister had cut and pasted his post from a poorly researched blog, but had removed the quotes and source. I shared my findings with my colleague, who confronted the minister about his plagiarism. Instead of editing his original post, he doubled down, claiming it was his and that he'd learned it from school textbooks and the History Channel. First, there are very few good histories on Halloween, most coming out in the 1990s, long after this man graduated school. Second, when my colleague specifically posted the link to the blog he had plagiarized, the pastor made no comment. In other words, a member of the clergy lied in order to tell what he believed to be the truth and refused to repent of it. Jesus calls himself light and encourages his followers to be the same. While there's lots to discuss and critique around Halloween, we have to be on guard that our personal fears and paranoias aren't so triggered that we bypass the hard work of self-examination and research in favor of tricking others into believing sanctified horror stories that not only misrepresent history, but also the Lord of Light we claim to serve. It's time for Christians to wake up from the nightmare before Halloween that we use to trick people and instead treat topics and others with more nuanced dialogue regarding the dangers we see facing society. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Beast and Bible. In our next episode, I sit down with a Halloween scholar to take a look at the often misunderstood history behind the holiday. Thank you for listening.
Beast and Bible is written, researched, produced, and hosted by Dr. Seth Pierce. Ethan Geck is our editor. Logo design and social media by Chelsea Ernina. Equipment and tech help from the dynamic duo James Giganti and Stephen Husett. Producing and project help from me, Heather Moore. Thanks for listening to Beast and Bible. Tell your friends about us, and don't forget to leave a nightlight on after dark.